Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Nick Blackburn. Nick Blackburn is a therapist and completed a PhD in English literature at Cambridge. His first book, The Reactor, is published this week on the 20th of January.
Hi, Nick. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast. It's so good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Hi.
So we're here to talk about your book, The Reactor, which comes out on the 20th of January. And it's a memoir about grief, loss and regeneration written in the wake of the sudden death of your father. So that must have been very shocking. Could you speak about what led you to write and pick up a pen after his death?
Yeah. I suppose it was shocking. The weird thing about being in shock, I guess, is that you're not really there, right? And I guess it was kind of a combination of the bits of me weren't really there. And then, someone was writing things. And it's the other thing about shocking things that, of course, we don't actually have the choice not to be there. So this odd sort of dissociative thing happens, doesn't it? And that's kind of a lot of what goes on in the book, really. Also, like, my father, I guess, had been quite ill for a long time and a bit ill for a really, really long time. So he died in February 2018, so it's coming up to 4 years ago, which, given the last 2 years, feels like 10 years. It feels like a long time. And it's strange that, I mean, for all of the sort of sorting out and sifting and making sense and containing operations that I guess I've sort of been involved in while writing the book through the process of doing that, and, you know, my general kind of work as a therapist, there's a lot of that that goes on, but it was a really odd, fast, strange, unpleasant period. Yeah. I guess I still find it quite confusing.
Yeah, and I think a sense of not you being in shock, but a lot of things happening in your brain kind of disconnected as a way does come out in the book, in a sense. You draw throughout the book, given that it's called The Reactor, you draw a link between the death of your father and the explosion of the reactor at Chernobyl in 1986. I wanted to ask you about what drew you to draw these two events, one very personal, the other very global, together.
So my experience was as simple as my father went into hospital on the Wednesday before he was dead on Saturday. And I think for the first time in a few years, although I had seen it before, I found that I wanted to watch. There was a particular, I think it's a BBC documentary about Sellafield and sort of decontamination of that. There was a lot of experimental stuff that went on at Sellafield in the early sort of period of the kind of nuclear age, and stuff to do with the British atom bomb and all that sort of thing. And I watched that, and then I think I probably went back to a documentary about the Chernobyl explosion in the same week, and just in watching on my laptop at night. And I suppose in retrospect, I was watching people coping with things, right? Or watching this kind of destruction that almost it's been contained by history. I mean, various other things. But at the same time, I suppose also what was happening was a kind of connection with my fairly early life. So I was sort of 4 years old. When that reactor exploded. And I think I probably saw documentaries or like news about it at the time. I think I remember seeing like a rerun of what I think was probably like the China Syndrome film, also about nuclear accident, which I think came out just after that rather than just after Three Mile Island. But anyway, these it was just sort of around. And I remember, I said this in the book, like sort of, I guess it was kind of panic buying really, but I remember like I was getting powdered milk because like the fallout had, was slightly more serious up in the north, where we were, where I am today, in fact. There were, you know, there were some fields that were contaminated and so on. And but yeah, just that it was a sort of like an early panic that came into my life. I think probably also at a time when my father was quite ill. He was bipolar, had that diagnosis and whatever that means, or a manic depressive, as he was called at the time. And I think he was probably getting like electroconvulsive therapy around that time, which again, so these sort of rather appalling kind of things were going on around then. And yeah, I suppose I found myself going back to that. And also, so with all of these things, unfortunately, that it, both the documentaries I'm thinking are very beautiful things. And another thing in the book is the awfulness of, well, my capacity, I'm not going to account for everyone else's, but I don't think it's all that uncommon to look at something really horrendous and go, oh, that it's sort of to kind of aestheticize it in a way.
Definitely. You talk at the end of the book about the forest fires in Australia and how shocking and horrible they are, but there's also a sense you describe how if they're in Europe or something, they'd reach from London to Moscow. I'm not quite sure if that's exactly right, but there's the same sense there of kind of their aesthetic scale and their aesthetic impressiveness at the same time as them being incredibly horrible as well.
Yeah. Well, and our kind of delight in finding a form of words that sort of colonizes that experience in a way.
Yeah, definitely. So much of the book, as you've already discussed, deals with the fact that your father was ill when you were growing up as well, in a way, and he was absent in a sense even when he was alive. So the only photo you have of you two together is when you're both in McDonald's holding strawberry milkshakes. How did you go about approaching this absence when you're writing a memoir about the loss of somebody who meant so much to you?
Well, I'm thinking about the phrase "nature abhors a vacuum." Right. And there is something about that I think I find it so difficult to keep a space out, to be able to bear a kind of an empty space in that sense. Or a lot of my interest in writing and speaking and thinking, and I've always kept myself busy, kind of has that quality to it of, I mean, I also as a therapist, you know, people coming to me with kind of anxiety or ADHD diagnosis, or I think there's a whole thing at the moment about how our sort of the terror of just being sort of waiting and floating and being blank or empty, it can be really terrifying for reasons that we often don't allow ourselves to think about. Yeah, this thing of like of knowing him and not knowing him, I'm going to say it's complicated. And in another way, it wasn't that complicated at all. I mean, I think one of the things that I do in the book, which is peculiar but maybe is understandable, is like I talk about lots and lots of things that are a bit like my feelings about my father, rather than actually I sort of get away in a sense, and it I think in the same way therapists can be rather slippery about both talking about their patients and sort of ethical terms and talking about themselves, you know, with their patients or but like in a way that there wasn't all that much, it feels like there wasn't all that much to say. I mean, yeah, my father had sort of his own kind of problems, a lot of which he just didn't really talk about, or didn't really have a language to talk about, or let me see, I'm about to start generalizing, right, which is bad. It's bad. It's everything that's wrong with the world, and yet we have to do it. About to tell you something about men who were born in the 1940s. I mean, you know, what does that mean? Any of those words. But yeah, he didn't really talk about his own feelings very often. I don't think that's that unusual. And we didn't really talk about our relationship that often. And that was fine when he was alive, that he could just be like around in the house. He worked from home. He worked very hard. I think he was good at his job. He was an accountant. I don't think anyone was particularly aware that he was sort of ill or had a, you know, would we count mental health as a disability or not? You know, he was just getting on with his thing, was sort of quite heavily, but one might say successfully medicated for a lot of his life. That was through his choice, it seemed. You know, but no one was really around saying, well, actually occasionally people, you know, me included, but we did sort of you know, push for the idea that he'd have therapy, and I think he went to see someone maybe once and then didn't go back, or but yeah, and so in a way, like, and this, so this thing that I think is in the book about me only having one photograph of him. I mean, there's another photograph just sort of kind of next to me as I'm talking. Like, we do have other photographs, but I think at the time there was like, there was that one that was on my phone or something. And this thing of when someone dies that you're suddenly like, oh, it's a bit like having your account deleted or something, and like thinking, oh, well, I'd stored all that stuff in you. Like, I was just waiting to ask you so I could retrieve that. Oh, what do I, or where are all my passwords? Or where are, oh no, what did I leave there? Like having your car impounded or something, like, oh, what was inside? I can't remember. And that is confusing, because one has to then take responsibility or to engage in the process of abrogating responsibility onto other new people and things. Yeah,
and in the book, in place of kind of talking directly about your father, you talk about songs, art, books, figures from popular culture, from Alexander McQueen to Fleetwood Mac, Hans Christian Andersen to Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. Do you have any sense of what drew you to each of these people or songs or bands or things?
Well, as part of my sort of weird journey into being a psychoanalyst, if we want to use that word, I came into the way of this thing called free association, which I spent like years, you know, sort of like twice a week, I would go into a room with a man who was sort of sitting in the corner of the room, and I would lie down and I would talk for 50 minutes in whatever, you know, however stupid or disgusting or nonsensical what it was that came out. And some things would come back to me, but I'd sort of formed chains of association like that, and some of them would be understandable reflections of things that had happened that week or that day, or, you know, responses to the news, and some of them would be surprisingly more like magic. I suppose that's the thing in the book, really, that, you know, it's written over a sort of 3.5 year period from really the point of him dying, these sort of early notes, and it's all kind of condensations of notes, really, notes in my phone mainly. It's kind of lots of these little bits, like sort of, I suppose they are like exploded pieces of something or bits of my mind, or but at the same time, of course, it does give you quite an intimate map of the cultural reference points that, for better or worse, kind of define me and I hope some other people. I mean, and even I was talking to my mum last night about something, and I wasn't particularly conscious of the fact that, so one of the references that comes in at the start and the end of the book is the Hollies, this song, The Air That I Breathe, which I've always really liked, but I wasn't particularly aware that they're a Salford band, you know, it's not from very far away from here, really. And there's a lot of kind of like things that I'm not like, oh, I'm going to put a northern thing into the book now. And as you'll hear, I'm not the most sort of, you know, out and out kind of northern lad voice here. But it does, yeah, my baggage is from a particular, it's like one of those sort of, I don't hear about it so much anymore. You know, there used to be like those diets where you'd only eat things from like near where you were from. That would be good for you in some way. But like, yeah, it's all like, it's all in the sort of, it's all the spores of all this stuff are kind of around here, I suppose. But also from lots of other places. I mean, yeah, but it's my fault.
I really liked how the second section of the book was called Hajira, one of the best ever Joni Mitchell albums.
Oh, yeah. Just like have a 5-minute silence for Joni Mitchell and that album. And you know, I hadn't really, and this is another bizarre, irresponsible, perverse thing about me and my writing and so on, that I was absolutely obsessed with Coyote on Hajira for like, yeah, the period of writing that section. You know, listen again and again and again. And that guitar bit at the beginning, oh, it's so good. But loads of other things on that album. Like, I had not listened to that thoroughly through and through as an album. And it turns out the whole thing is absolute genius. But like the things like Black Crow, you know, and it's a song for Sharon. It's ridiculously good. Yes. What a genius.
She is. And also because everyone would think that the Joni Mitchell album of like loss, grief and regeneration would be Blue, but you're like, no, I don't want any of Blue.
Yeah. I mean, they're all, you know, there's plenty of loss to go around, isn't there? I mean, I guess all art is about loss in a way, isn't it? There's a line for you.
If we're going to talk more about like the cultural references and that aspect of the book, one of the most emotional parts I found was the little vignette you describe of Bob Dylan and Joan Baez discussing Dylan typing like ticker tape. She says, "I used to feed you salad and red wine whilst you wrote like ticker tape," and they're talking about the Ballad of Hattie Carroll. I've watched, it's from the Rolling Thunder Review, isn't it? Or it's an interview with them. I've watched that, and yes, it's the saddest little snippet of an interview, because at the end they discuss why they never really got together. And Baez says, "I married the man I thought I loved." And Dylan replies, "See, that's what thought has to do with it. Thought will fuck you up." And in the book, you describe how much that annoyed you. And it is one of the saddest interactions ever. Yeah.
And it's annoyed me because it's so, it's so funny and precise, and he sort of wins in that little moment, and it's like this little tennis match, and yet he's saying, you know, and of course this, you know, you might say this rather than feel, it's very, living and feeling something is very different, right? And it is rather like this sort of reenacted scene. It's really extraordinary little moment. Like they're sort of acting in a Noel Coward play or something. It's fascinating, and the sort of erotic pull between the two of them, and yet it's also very, very posed. And but you think she's really putting something emotional on the line in those moments, and he's being quite flip about it, and yet you sort of he kind of scores the point. Anyway,
he definitely comes across as the meaner, slightly more annoying winner of the conversation there. Yeah,
and I suppose it's, yeah, I think I kind of use it in the book about, I mean, there's all sorts of things sort of in the air in that little bit, but while it does sort of, because again, as in so many different parts of the book, I put that in because I was rather obsessed with it. And then I sort of afterwards thought, oh, I guess I'm sort of writing about my parents, aren't I? Or I'm writing about men and women, or I'm writing about power and gender relations and the kind of destruction and repair that I suppose is there in all sexual desire and marriages. And maybe it's just about people struggling with difficulty, right? And somehow sort of being okay with that. And I find I'm very attracted to difficult people. I suppose perhaps that means that I am a difficult person. Hard as that might be to believe from speaking to me. Yeah, just like turmoily kind of combative people, I think I've got a bit of a sweet tooth for, I suppose. And I guess I'm probably remembering stuff that I experienced as a child as well.
Yeah. So your book kind of follows in the footsteps a bit of Max Porter's Grief is the Thing with Feathers, and maybe some of Anne Carson's work, like the Glass essay written in the aftermath of her father's death, who died with dementia. Had you thought about either of those things or been influenced by them in any way?
I really love Anne Carson. I think it's probably bits of float of hers that have kind of, it's often the shape of things on the page, or I think probably with Max Porter's book, which I did have around, and I think like almost the shape of the object, and something about the sort of the mise en page and the weight of that book, I think must be my idea. It's just kind of in the culture, isn't it? But in another way, I think I've been able, you know, if I'm being really honest, I haven't read very much grief literature, or I haven't read, you know, as if that, I mean, is that a bit like women's writing, whatever that is, you know, that it's a bit like, no, these are books that people have written. I absolutely adore the other bird-related grief book, which is Helen MacDonald's H is for Hawk, which I think maybe really gets into the sort of the madness and the violence of it in a very daring and vulnerable way. In a way that it happens that I've not quite got so much from other things. That's partly through being a bit of a sort of blockhead in terms of being able to get into a lot of things. Yeah, and I suppose the other one is Love's Work, the Gillian Rose book, but that's a very different... I suppose like fiction as well about that sort of thing. I probably read less of. I might read ghost stories more than I read grief stories, I suppose. What that says.
Well, talking about ghost stories, perhaps the most famous story about a man who loses his father is Hamlet, and you do discuss Hamlet in the later parts of your book, but I started feeling it appearing in the book quite early on. There's a moment where you say it is wild to be alive when your father is deaf, and also another one where you say I am in mourning for this vile holiday, which is almost like Hamlet being very, very cross about the funeral baked meats, that kind of follow on too fast. Had you noticed them? Any like Hamlet streams coming into your writing, do you think, before you end up talking about Polonius and Ophelia?
I noticed myself saying that there is a bit where I say, this genuinely really awful thing that happened like a week before my father died, when he did confuse me with my uncle. And I did find myself writing this particular line where Hamlet says, "You're my uncle, oh God," right at the start, and I heard myself say, you know, and also of course Hamlet is as much a play about someone who can't get rid of their father. I mean, if only the dead had stayed dead in that play, but the dead want everyone else dead as well, which sort of spoke to a kind of a sort of superstitious fear that was very haunted after he died. I mean, that was the other kind of really dominant experience, sort of at night time through that kind of winter. And in the house, it's quite a small house here. And I think the other thing that one has to say is it's also a book about an encounter with narcissism and how one's defense against horror is often making oneself the center of the world. I think a lot of dreadful evils have been perpetuated often by men in the name of that, you know, lest you be allowed to kind of cut off my penis, I'm gonna annihilate everyone and everything. And I think the sort of like cultural sort of weight of Hamlet, of one of the kind of malest, whitest things, and the appalling misogynistic treatment of Ophelia in that play, appalling. And we don't talk about it. We can't talk about the racism of Othello. I think it's conscious of that. I'm not sure even how much horror of what is done to Ophelia is really mediated at all in Hamlet. I suppose we're just supposed to recognise that the play is about vile people. But of course we all, I mean, there's this love for Hamlet and his suffering. And a sort of a beauty with which Ophelia's kind of violent death is relayed by Gertrude, who does get to survive for a while. And I mean, it's, what a mess.
There's one line you say quite early on in the book, and it's like the only line on the page, and it's reading back what I wrote or something makes me laugh. Grief makes people very self-centered. And that is almost a comment on both your grief and also I think it comes after or just before that, the things that ring quite true of Hamlet in many ways. So it feels like a comment on that as well.
And in a sense, the book is a bit of a trap like this, because there is, I mean, one of several wonderful quotes from an interview with Joni Mitchell, where she's talking about like psychological language and how sort of psychology is, as she says, like ruining language. I mean, I think also the fact that it's an interview with Morrissey is really hilarious, but an ego, but that these sort of words, as if we know what they mean and so on, but just the kind of I think the book is an attempt to take responsibility, and yet at the same time there's limits to the kind of responsibility one takes on in a book without at the same time sort of taking responsibility out of me and into words. And I think it's very interesting. I have to do the recording for the audio book. And there's some bits of it that, of course, I can write down, but actually saying it out loud without crying, or saying it out loud without mispronouncing things, you know, some quite important things like names or foreign words, or you know, things that affect other people's actual lives. It's like, you know, I know how to say my own child's name, or you know, this family member's name, or you know, I don't know, but I put it in. These sort of like that, it's all this way that like the process of kind of joining to certain things but then being alienated to certain things, and like I suppose this is what they call reification, isn't it, of once you start putting things into objects, it all sorts of there is a violence to putting things into words, but in another way great violence can be done when we don't put things into words. It needs to be an ongoing process, doesn't it, I suppose.
Yeah. I think that's really, really interesting the way you talk about it. It's very eloquent as well. It's kind of struck by the book's form, the way that each page has its own separate heading, and then it's very rare that they go over a page, each kind of entry. So you know you did your PhD on Renaissance literature. As I was reading more and more of it, and so much of the book is also directed at unspecified you, which I imagine is you in a sense, but I got something of the sonnet sequence. There's something of like a sequence of things that come after each other that are dedicated to one person, either your father or you in a sense. Do you think you had any sense of that when you were writing it as well?
Yes. I don't think I was aware of that. I think I was probably thinking of more recent things like Patrick DeWitt's wonderful book Ablutions, or there's like a Calvino book in Invisible Cities that is sort of like often things of just a page or sort of short things, and yeah, and Anne Carson, and layouts of certain plays as well, maybe. Or but yeah, I was very interested at one point in sonnet sequences. I think that was probably in the masters I did. And I remember, yeah, there's an idea, I think it's in As You Like It, Shakespeare play, of sort of like nailing bits of poems to trees and things, as if like the, and they're called leaves in a book, right, you know, but these sort of single things that are a bit sort of, I got interested in all sorts of weird geeky printing stuff, which, you know, I expect you want to talk about for hours and hours, and your listeners will be fascinated by it. But yeah, there's these things called like florons that you get in sort of like printed leaves or little squiggly bits you get in sonnets, and there's this whole like plants and pages, and but yeah, like I became a bit obsessed with layout stuff, and it's, yeah, there was a whole thing about sonnet sequences, yeah, as being these very physical things. And yeah, of course, they are all one page things, and there's a personalness to them, and I suppose there's something that Shakespeare, maybe more than some other sort of sonnet cyclists, was doing, or that we think he's doing, in terms of like trying to sort of materialize the memory of someone onto a page, because a lot of those are about loss, aren't they, or not being able to have children, or yeah. And that amazing phrase in the sonnet about the dyer's hand, the hand of the person that sort of does the printing ink or kind of dyes the garments or whatever, and that the hand, I get very obsessed with hands in the book as well, I don't know why really, but yes. There's sort of this wing of like ink and tattooing and traces and staining, and but the divisions break down between the medium and the body, and yeah, the rich tapestry. Yeah,
so fascinating, it really is. I was also really struck by the fact that so each of the page's entries are so personal in a way, and then you turn the page on the last one, it goes straight into the acknowledgements, and it looks the same on the page. It's a very conscious lack of boundary between the text itself and the things outside the text, in a way. Yeah
it's quite also we ran out of pages, they wouldn't give me any more pages. I'd quite have liked a blank, you know, a blank page could be nice here and there, but then I'd already sort of, I think it sort of contracted and expanded somewhat in the writing and revision process. I mean, it was bought by the lovely Faber and Faber a year and a bit ago, something like that. And I think they'd sort of, there was like a deadline for the manuscript, and I'm still tweaking and twerking bits, like about, I think they finally made me stop about 3 months ago, but I think years ago, it was around the time that wonderful St. Ali Smith's seasonal quartet things coming out, and this idea of sort of novels and publication being sort of having this kind of journalistic sort of urgency thing. And of course, I would have the book felt so kind of urgent in some ways. I mean, I suppose just as a document of someone who just died 3 years ago, and then of course then there was all the Trump stuff, and I was like, oh yeah, put that in, you know, it's all about annihilation, and then all of the kind of viral contagion-y kind of stuff from the pandemic, and that it's just sort of, unfortunately, it's all trending, isn't it? Annihilation, infection, and boundaries breaking down. Yeah.
On that cheery note, we should probably end. But thank you so much, Nick. That was a really fabulous conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.